This is Peace Talks, the radio series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution strategies to use for ourselves, our families, our neighborhoods, our communities, our countries, and our world. Today, Native American takes on peace. We'll talk today with Laura Ramirez, author of the book Keepers of the Children, Native American Wisdom and Parenting.
In the Native American culture, children are seen as adults' spiritual equals.
Later, we'll hear about the Great Law of Peace, the founding constitution of the Six Nations Iroquois Confederacy, from Professors Orrin Lyons and John Mohawk.
The diplomats required that the warriors who came to talk about peace first stop killing people while we're talking. And then the idea was, as long as we're talking, nobody's killing anybody.
That's all today on Peace Talks. This is Peace Talks, the radio series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution strategies. I'm Paul Ingalls with Carol Boss. Today we're exploring Native American approaches to peacemaking, and in the second half of our show, we'll learn about the Great Law of Peace, the founding constitution of the Six Nations Iroquois Confederacy. But first, Native American wisdom applied to making peace in our homes. Mother Teresa said, "If there's no peace in the world today, it's because there's no peace in the family. Help your families to become centers of compassion and forgive constantly, and so bring peace." Today we'll talk with Laura Ramirez, author of the book Keepers of the Children, Native American Wisdom and Parenting. Laura's husband of 15 years is Larry Ramirez, a member of the Pascua Yaqui tribe. They have two boys, Dakota and Colt, and live in northern Nevada. In her book, Laura Ramirez uses little-known Native American concepts and teaching stories to help parents raise children in a manner that, she says, allows them to unfold the gifts within their hearts. By teaching children how to create fulfilling lives, she says parents deepen their sense of satisfaction and understanding of their own lives. Carol Boss talked with Laura Ramirez, author of Keepers of the Children, Native American Wisdom and Parenting.
Can you give us a sense of the difference in thinking as you see it between the white and Native cultures?
Well, the differences are huge, starting with the difference in discipline. In the mainstream world, typically, we punish our children to try to keep them in line, whereas in the Native world, they believe in teaching a child to develop the self-discipline to make the right choices on his own. So that right there is a very big difference, and it creates a very different dynamic between the parent and the child. Another really important difference is the way Native people see children. You know, it wasn't too long ago in this culture that women and children were seen as property. And a lot of parents today still view their children as their property, whereas in the Native American culture, children are seen as adults' spiritual equals. So it's a very different way of seeing the child. You know, how this all kind of came about for me, when I first started dating my husband, and I had dated quite a bit, and at this point in my life, I had traveled around the world, and I had been exposed to a number of different cultures, I started to see that he was wise, that he was kind, and he was compassionate and generous, yet at the same time, he was nobody's fool. He was very psychologically savvy. And when we decided to have children, I made a conscious decision to cultivate these same qualities in our children. And I was also very aware of the importance of raising our children with ideas from both their cultures. And so what I did is I did a lot of research and I did a lot of self-reflection. And I really thought about which ideas from each of these cultures would be most humane and most resourceful in raising my children.
Well, do you think parents who are raising biracial children as you have, or children adopted from other countries or cultures, face special challenges? And, you know, if so, what are some of them?
I think absolutely they do, because identity becomes a big issue. Because when your children are biracial or when they're multiracial, they don't look like everybody else. And so people instantly want to categorize you. They want to know, you know, well, they say things as insensitive as, what are you? You know, I mean, it's almost like, you know, what kind of mutt are you is almost what's implied in a question like that. And there has been a lot of pressure, for instance, in the Black community when a child is biracial, that at some point in that child's development, and it's usually around adolescence, that they need to choose. Do they want to be white or do they want to be Black? Now, obviously, you know, this is not just a Black and white issue. There are children who are Chinese and white. My children are Native American and white. And there are children who are multiracial as well. And so the idea here is not to alienate the child from one of his cultures, but to raise the child so that he gets the best of all of those worlds, so that he grows up with ideas from all of those cultures.
There are a number of Anglo people who carry a heavy dose of guilt over the role of whites through history in oppressing Native Americans and also other minorities. And I'm curious how you and your husband have bridged that historical and cultural schism between yourselves, and have your sons learned about that history?
Sure. We tell stories all the time in our family. I tell the story of how when I first met my husband's family, certain members of his family would ignore me. They would treat me like I was a ghost. People would come to my house and, you know, they'd expect me to feed them and provide for them, but they wouldn't even acknowledge me. And, you know, this is the deep pain that Native people suffer and continue to carry with them because of conquest, because so much was taken from them. And, you know, in our culture, we hear all the time about issues that are Black and white, and we don't hear very much about Native American issues. And I almost think that that's by design, because we did come over here and, you know, we're all squatting on land that did not originally belong to us. But Native people are coming into their own, and Native people, I think, are starting to realize that we all need to take our lessons learned and we need to go forward. And what I've done with this book is my attempt to bridge that gap, to heal that schism, and to bring together the best of these two different worlds in raising the children. And, you know, when I talk about children, I'm talking about, you know, not my children, not your children, but all the children.
And the potential, what about that for an internal struggle for mixed race or biracial children?
Well, I think that it's really important that we get beyond this idea that at some point a child has to choose his identity, because by virtue of making that choice, he alienates an aspect of his identity. He denies a part of himself, a part of his heritage, a part of how he sees the world. And I think that biracial and multiracial children who are raised with ideas from different cultures, from their own cultures and from other cultures as well, have a great opportunity to kind of use culture to transcend culture and to find that meeting place of common ground, which is our sense of humanity, our interdependence on on each other, and our interdependence on the earth.
You're listening to Peace Talks, a series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. Today we're visiting with Laura Ramirez, author of Keepers of the Children, Native American Wisdom and Parenting. Now, children do pick up on the ways in which their parents relate to the world. For example, they can see it as a scary place, or they can see it as a place filled with possibilities, a place where people are good or a world that is full of predators, should parents be consciously and purposefully assessing themselves and their own values and fears as they enter parenting?
Yes, they should. I think that parenting requires a lot of reflection, a lot of self-reflection, a lot of questioning of your own upbringing. And I think it's a serious mistake to do what was done to you, to just parent your kids the way your parents parented you. Because I believe in this concept of intergenerational evolution. And that means that each new generation deserves the tools to create a better life than we had. And, you know, this is what I'm giving to my children, a better life than I had. And that better life doesn't mean that they have more things or that they get to go more places. I mean, it may mean that they have more opportunities, but it means that they better understand the world and better see their place in it and how they can contribute to it.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when a child is born is that the parents spend a lot of time recognizing themselves and each other in the child. And this is actually a very important step in the bonding process because the parent needs to identify with the child in order to become the child's caretaker. But what we need to remember is that the child is not you, is not your husband, is not just some combination of the both of you, that the child is a unique entity unto himself. And my husband's tribe, the Pascua-Yaqui tribe, has a great story that illustrates this point. What they say is that when a woman is pregnant, she has a piece of turquoise inside her womb. And when that piece of turquoise is born into the world, it's the parent's job not to try to break it up, not to try to make it into something else, not to, you know, try to shape it into something other than what it is, but to polish it until its unique beauty comes to light. And this, to me, is the essence of parenting. And it really becomes a journey of discovery because you get to discover who your child is separate from yourself.
And in parents and wanting to really take care of and be protective of their children, how do they balance all of this with that desire to teach a child what they believe to be true about surviving in the world?
Sure. And I think that's why a lot of parents have difficulty with discipline versus punishment because, you know, they're so terrified that they're not going to give their children the tools that they need to survive in the world. For instance, here's a story from my husband's youth. When he was a baby, his father used to pinch his cheeks over and over and over, telling him, don't you cry, because he was trying to toughen him up, because that's how he saw the world. He saw the world as a dangerous place and that you had to be tough to survive. And, you know, when you put that in historical framework, when you understand what it must have been for his father to grow up in a time when you would walk down the street and in restaurants you would see signs that said things like, no dogs, no Indians allowed. You understand why he saw the world that way. And I think the world is a safer place now in a lot of regards, but it's become more dangerous in other regards. And that's why I think it's essential that parents, rather than, you know, protecting their children from the outside world, which you need to do at the beginning of the child's life, but they need to teach children how to see beyond a person's credentials, beyond their presentation, beyond the number of their possessions, to the actions that really reveal them. And so what you're doing is you're essentially you're giving your child a grounding in human psychology. You know, I've raised my children to understand that not all authorities have their best interests at heart, and this is very important.
You coach your children to challenge authority. Do they challenge your authority?
Yes.
And how does that work?
Yes, they do. Of course they do. They do all the time. And sometimes it's a little annoying, you know, I'll be honest with you. But you know, they do. Because in our family, we have very few rules. But the rules all make sense. And they're all based on striving toward this idea of becoming a humane human being and this idea of being all inclusive, which means that, you know, we're allowing each other to grow, that we're not blaming or shaming each other, that we're encouraging the development of our integrity and our humanity. And so, you know, my children do question me. And if I tell them something that doesn't make sense, then they'll question me, and I need to answer to that. And, you know, that's okay. You know, sometimes I get busted, and that's okay because, you know, they know that I'm not finished yet, that I have things to learn. And so, in a real sense, you know, they are the keeper of my own becoming. And it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. You have a story about how, a particular story of how you've taught one or both of your sons discipline.
Well, sure. You know, what I do all the time is, you know, we talk about behavior because I understand, you know, the word discipline comes from the Latin word discipulus, which means learner. And so I always keep in mind that my children are learning. You know, for instance, let's take a playground scenario. Let's take a situation where, you know, maybe there's a four-year-old and the four-year-old grabs a toy from his friend and the friend hits him. And so you can talk about, you know, what does it feel like to have something in your hand and have somebody just take it from you? And what does it feel like when somebody hits you? So first you talk to them about what they would feel like in that situation, and then you make a connection to their behavior in that situation. Well, how do you think your friend felt when you hit him? And then when you create that connection, what you actually create in the child is empathy, is an understanding of, oh, yeah, that must have hurt. And then from that place, you find a way to help them reconnect with their friend, either by, you know, saying I'm sorry or sharing a toy or what have you.
Laura Ramirez is our guest today on Peace Talks. She's the author of Keepers of the Children, Native American Wisdom and Parenting. What about the difference between reactive and responsive parenting?
What people need to understand is that reactive parenting, oftentimes, it's a reenactment of some unresolved scenario from your own childhood so that, you know, your child is bringing out in you something that needs attention, something that needs to be healed. And so what I like to say to parents, and, you know, sometimes parents really get it and they start to chuckle a little bit, is that, you know, when your child is pushing your buttons, those are great opportunities for you to learn, for you to reflect on your childhood and look at what you didn't get and make the choice to give that to your child. Responsive parenting is very different. Let's talk about a glass of milk because that's, you know, everybody can relate to that, you know, spill that's, you know, maybe the 10th spill in 3 days, and, you know, the parent is tired of cleaning up messes. A reactive parent would, you know, maybe stamp her feet or grit her teeth or, you know, might even say something hurtful to the child. I can't believe you did that again, that sort of thing. Whereas a responsive parent is going to take immediate action. She's going to respond according to the needs of the situation. Well, what are the needs of the situation when we have a 3-year-old who's spilling milk? To me, the greater need is to teach the child how to be responsive. Oh, you spilled your milk. Okay, well, let's clean it up together. So you teach the child how to respond in a situation like that. And so you do it together. And it becomes an opportunity for bonding. And then you're not dehumanizing the child because the child doesn't have the motor skills yet to hang on to a glass.
Let's talk a little bit about conflict resolution. How important is that to teach children the skills of conflict resolution?
Well, it's very important because, you know, there's conflict all over the place. There's conflict within the family, there's conflict at school, and there's conflict in the world. And when you teach children conflict resolution skills, you teach them tolerance, you teach them how to be humane, and you do that by inviting them to consider another perspective. And it's interesting, we do this in the Native American culture by using something called the talking stick. And, you know, all the talking stick really is just a symbol, it's a tool. And in the Native culture and in my family, when there's a conflict or when there's a disagreement about, you know, what we want to do, we sit in a circle. And the circle is very important. A circle is symbolic of this idea that we're all equal. And again, there's that concept of spiritual equality again, that we're all equal, that no one's first, no one has to be last. We're all on equal footing when we lead with our heart, when we express what's in our heart. So you sit in a circle and you have the talking stick in the center of the circle. And when someone feels compelled to speak, they pick up the stick. When they pick up the stick, that's a sign for everyone else to be silent and to listen, not to think about, you know, what they're going to say when it's their turn to hold the stick, but to actually listen and to consider the words of the speaker and to consider this person's pain. Because we know whenever there's conflict, there's pain. There's needs that aren't being met. And when that person has spoken what's in their heart and in our family and in, you know, the Native American world, it's done by using I, by saying, I feel this way. Because what you're doing is you're taking responsibility for your feelings. You're not blaming anybody else. You're saying, I feel this way. When you're finished speaking, you put down the stick or you pass it to someone else, and the next person speaks. And in this way, everybody gets a chance to be listened to. And this is very, very important for children to be listened to feel like they're seen, to feel like they're visible, to feel like their voices count. Because you got to remember, you know, we grew up in a time when there was a saying that children should be seen and not heard. And when you raise your children in that way, they'll find ways to make themselves visible to you, and it may not be a way that that you like very much.
Thank you so much, Laura Ramirez.
Oh, my pleasure.
Carol Boss talking with author Laura Ramirez. For more information about Ramirez's book, Keepers of the Children, Native American Wisdom and Parenting, you can visit our website, peacetalksradio.com. Look for the episode called Peaceful Parenting 3. That's peacetalksradio.com for more links to websites and books on peaceful parenting. You can also go to our website to hear this program again and to hear any of the programs in our series. I'm Paul Ingalls, and in a moment, more Native American peacemaking wisdom, the story of the peacemaker, after this break.
This is Peace Talks, the radio series on peacemaking and nonviolent solutions to conflict. I'm Carol Boss. Today on Peace Talks, we'll hear about the Great Law of Peace, which is the founding constitution of the Six Nations Iroquois Confederacy. Also known as the Haudenosaunee, the Confederacy, according to oral tradition, came together in ancient times through the efforts of the one who came to be known as the Peacemaker. We'll be hearing the story of the Peacemaker today from Orin Lyons, faith keeper of the Turtle Clan of the Onondaga Nation of the Haudenosaunee. Lyons, a professor of American Studies at the State University of New York at Buffalo, will tell us more about the principles of the Great Law of Peace. In addition, we'll be featuring comments from John Mohawk of the Seneca Nation, also a professor at Buffalo. He's been active in diplomatic circles for the Seneca Nation for years, as well as being a farmer, writer, and magazine editor. John Mohawk will expand on the peace principles and talk about how they could be applied by individuals and other nations to help create a more peaceful world today. Both of our guests were recorded at the State University of New York at Buffalo. This is Orin Lyons with the story of Peacemaker.
The Peacemaker was a spiritual messenger, came to our people some 1,000 years ago. We're not certain. We don't have a precise date for that, but it's very old, long before our brother came to us across the sea. And he came into warring nations. The Mohawks, Oneidas, Onondagas, Cayugas, and Senecas were battling not only one another, but internally as well. It was a very, very chaotic state of affairs the time that he came here to bring us peace. Now, he has a long story about his birth and how he was brought up and how he came across the great Ontario Lake. In a stone white canoe, and first visited the Mohawks. And he had to convince the Mohawks of his abilities and who he was. And he did bring them around to using their common sense and their good minds, which was a great feat. Then they collectively took the leaders from them, and they went to visit the Oneidas, and the same thing happened. Came to the Onondagas, and a very powerful leader by the name of Tododaho did not allow them to penetrate, and so they went around and went to the Cayugas, and the people of the swamp, and then finally over to the Senecas.
Lyons says the Senecas were at first difficult to convince of the peaceful path, but the tribe eventually came on board. The Peacemaker then turned to his toughest challenge, going back to try and win over the menacing leader of the Onondagas, Tododaho.
Tododaho, the leader, a very evil man, very twisted and a cannibal and just about all the bad things that you can think of, very powerful as well. But they got to him with the help of a woman who he had met on the first night of his landfall in Mohawk country, and her name was Jagunsasa. She was from the Cat Nation, Erie, and she had a lodge. And so her practice was to feed the men who were on the warpath. They would stay overnight at her lodge, and they would eat. And she had a rule of law that no fighting, leave your weapons outside. And so it was natural for her to embrace this stranger coming to her, and he talked to her about what he was doing. She thought that was a wonderful idea, and she was very supportive of it. And he went on to do what he was doing. Now he sent back for her because they were having such a problem with Tododaho. They could not penetrate. And she came back with a song. She says, "I have a song." She taught this song to the men, and they approached the Tododaho singing. And they said he was very deformed, almost not recognizable as a human, and even his hair was writhing with snakes. And he came out of the swamp, and they could see the snakes falling from his head as they approached him, and he was transforming. But still he was not convinced, and finally they agreed that if he would join their confederation of peace, then the central fire would be at Onondaga, and all heretofore leaders, the primary leader would be coming from Onondaga and would carry his name as a title.
It's a tradition that continues to this day. The peace chief now carrying the title Tathadaho is a man named Sidney Hill, who still travels among the nations of the Iroquois to settle disputes and keep the peace, trying to practice what the peacemaker preached to the leaders of the nations so long ago on the southeast shore of Onondaga Lake, known as the Great Law of Peace. Again, Orin Lyons.
First principle, peace. Second principle, equity, justice for the people. And third, the power of the good minds, of the collective powers to be of one mind, unity and health. All of these things were involved in his basic principles. And the process of discussion and putting aside warfare as a method of reaching decisions, and now using intellect. And he laid down a very precise process for our governance, and which is, of course, basic, is that it is the people's will and it is their agreement to government. They are the ones that will consent to government, government by consent. And you establish two houses, and the two houses, the elder brothers and the younger brothers, Mohawks, Onondagas, Senecas were the elder brothers, Cayugas and Oneidas were the younger brothers, and later on, around 1713, 1721, the Tuscarora Nation joined and joined with the younger brothers. So a process was established of discussion and consensus.
And bearing in mind the key role that the woman Teguinsesa had played in winning the peacemaker, right from the beginning, made women powerful players in the politics of the Indian nation.
He gave the women the responsibility to choose all leaders and to oversee their conduct, and they had the power of recall. So that was an enormous responsibility for the women, but I think it was a genius that has us still existing today, that process still being used, and the abilities of women to choose a different style of leader. Then he gave, he planted a great symbol called the Great Tree of Peace, which is the white pine. And he illustrated that this pine had four white roots of truth that reach in the four cardinal directions of the earth. And those people who had no place to go could come and follow the route back to its source and come under the shelter of the Great Law of Peace. He established the idea of disarmament when he then uprooted this great tree, and he commanded the men to come forward and throw their weapons of war into this hole. And they did. And then he replaced the tree on top. So often in a depiction of the Great Tree of Peace, you will see a war club or arrows, a bow and arrows, or a hatchet underneath it. And that is where this term burying the hatchet comes from.
John Mohawk says that many Indian tribes in North America have explored the nonviolent path when faced with a threat.
You can find the tradition of peacemaking among Native peoples in North America, in the woodlands and across to the northern Great Plains. You'll hear this theme over and over again. The Haudenosaunee, I think, are best known for it because they probably did the most to develop a whole range of strategies and institutions that are very well known. In the 17th and 18th centuries was the most influential, because it was the thing that the Americans at the very beginning of the American Republic were most familiar with.
It was at a meeting in Lancaster, Pennsylvania in 1744 when an Onondaga chief stood and chided the governors that were arguing amongst themselves, governor of New York, Pennsylvania, governor of Delaware and Virginia, I believe, were arguing amongst themselves over land, and he stood there and he said to them, You know, he says, you'll never amount to anything until you learn how to sit in council together in a peaceful way. And make a union like ours, he said. Look how powerful we are. Look how old we are. And look how strong we are, because we come with this idea of union based on peace. And those words were written down by Cadwalder Colden, who was an interpreter and also took a lot of notes all during those times. And he's published some books in those times and great reading. But anyway, those notes were taken to Philadelphia, and the publisher of that particular book that was made from those meetings there in Lancaster was none other than Ben Franklin. And Ben Franklin responded to that instruction. Says, good idea. The eve of the revolution, Continental Congress sent a delegation to the Haudenosaunee and asked them to join them in the coming battle. And the Haudenosaunee responded saying, we know your father. We have good relations with your father. And we know you, and we have good relations with you as well. We see this as a battle between father and son. And we would rather not partake. We think this is something you have to settle between yourselves. And they responded by saying, good, because that was our second request. If you are not going to fight with us, then don't fight against us.
According to John Mohawk, most of the basic principles of peacemaking practiced among Indian nations hundreds of years ago are still essential to effective peacemaking today, including the concept of a safe haven for peace talks.
You have to have that. The people who are going to talk about peace have to know they won't be assassinated on the way to or from the conversation. And so Onondaga, they guaranteed it. They said, if you come here, you'll be safe. And so they devised ways of talking about this. But the first requirement that was on the books was that first you have to do no harm, almost like how doctors are supposed to not do any harm. The diplomats required that the warriors who came to talk about peace first stop killing people while we're talking. And then the idea was, as long as we're talking, nobody's killing anybody. So there was a kind of idea of facilitating what you would call truces. Now, the people on the other sides of the conflict often didn't have any leadership. There was no single person or group on the other side of some of these wars that could end the war. So you had to bring them all, if you could, or as many of them as you could. The council proceedings was aimed at much at the population that was hostile, as it was at the warriors and the leaders of the warriors. It was aimed at the people behind them. They had to have people who were supplying them. They had to have support. They had to have cheering when they got home. They had to have a feeling that they were solid and doing the right thing. And the council conversations were often designed lessen support for the violence in the villages that the perpetrators came from. So it was a very complicated thing. It's a very complicated thing to try to get to people who don't accept any authority. They simply don't accept authority. Individual warriors could get up in the morning and drive a hatchet into a post in some place in the Ohio Valley or far away and urge. He'd come to the middle of the village and drive his hatchet into the post, and he would announce to the rest of the village, I am forming a war party. Everybody who's forming one with me, put your hatchet under my hatchet. And then he'd call a meeting with them, and they'd go raid somebody. So the village knew, and they picked a leader. He offered himself as a leader, and he was going to lead the war effort, or the raid, or whatever it was. That was the kind of deal. It was small, cellular, often no way to predict it, no way to address it. So this is what the Six Nations offered. There would always be some place to address that. Somebody could come walking out of the forest and into Onondaga and say, I come from the Miamis. Didn't have to be a Miami war chief, but at least he could take a message back that they would offer to hear what was the grievance. The rules are real complicated. I don't want to reduce these to simplicity. There's a kind of thing of all we have to do is hold hands and sing songs and we'll have peace. Wasn't like that.
Fairness is always the underlying quality. That's what John was talking about. And he said if the person that is bringing the grievance is assured of being heard and being understood fairly, then they will try. Everybody will try if they know that the whole process is designated to solving the problem rather than having one side or the other win. So I think that that is fundamentally important in terms of solving these international problems. You have to have what I would say probably could establish a World Council of Elders, such as Mandela and Dalai Lama and people of that nature. Certainly they could offer a different perspective than if you would have a council of warriors.
You're listening to Peace Talks, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. You can hear all the programs in our series online at peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com. I'm Carol Boss, and today we're hearing from John Mohawk and Orrin Lyons, professors at the State University of New York at Buffalo, both a Haudenosaunee, also known as the Iroquois, acknowledged throughout history as a people with a strong and effective peacemaking tradition. Once again, John Mohawk.
Organized armed aggression, otherwise war, has often motivated societies to organize, to do something to provide for the safety of its people. In this case of the Haudenosaunee, there were two things that were going on. There was organized armed aggression, and there was the internalized chaos of what we could call blood feuding or civil war. Both things were happening at various moments. Most of the time when societies respond to these, they respond to them by organizing their own form of force. So they meet force with force. So the usual thing is to find a way to raise an army and to expel the invaders or to bring some form of control. But I want to point out that the Haudenosaunee, instead of emphasizing the organization of force to meet force, it built its culture around the idea of organizing for peace, organizing for some method of response other than force.
Peace is not passive.
Orrin Lyons.
Peace is very, very dynamic, and it requires a whole lot of effort. It's so easy to just strike out in anger. It's very difficult to control yourself and to find another way to vent. And that's what we face, and that's how we have to deal with it. And right now, all I see is the force that John is talking about, and people always underestimate the will of a people. So I think that the idea of peacemaking is a very old one here, but it's also very complex because of the divergence of thinking. The Western idea, the Western thought, I think was done very well by a woman who wrote a law treatment. And that was Mary Christina Wood in the Oregon Law Review. She wrote this in 1944, and it's called The Politics of Abundance and the Politics of Scarcity. And that is, I think she encapsulated in this discussion very clearly the problem that we had. The politics of abundance for Indians was to always be respectful of the natural world and to have ceremonies and to make sure that the next generations were taken care of. Indeed, the peacemaker said to our leaders that every decision we make must regard the seventh generation coming. And we shouldn't think of ourselves, nor of our family, nor even our generation, but make our decision on behalf of seven generations. And most Indian nations that I know, and I know most of them, all have the same respect and reverence for life and for the future and responsibility. So that was a politics of abundance. Politics of scarcity comes from our brothers, and I think Ms. Woods really illustrated that very well, which is to say when things get scarce, then they make rules and they make laws and they make things scarce. I mean, when they're, you know, the salmon discussion that she illustrates about when there were just abundance beyond comprehension of so many salmon coming up on so many rivers and the Willamette and just all these great rivers just full of salmon. And today it's hard to find them there. That's the politics of scarcity. That is the idea of taking more than you need and taking at the expense of your grandchildren.
John Mohawk thinks that many Indian nations which have had a high respect for peace have long known what it takes to address conflict within communities and from without. Many nations had a peace chief as well as a war chief that held equal sway in responding to conflict scenarios.
For the most part, when people are at war, they have a grievance. They feel that they're being mistreated, that justice is not their thing. So the principle of the great peace is that justice in the end has to prevail. But everybody knows that people aren't satisfied with justice. They'll get justice today, and then tomorrow their demands will go up. So they also knew that the process of dealing with people was ongoing. You didn't get a closure and then go home. You got somewhere, and then you had a process by which you talked about the next layer of things that are causing conflict. So things must have been pretty busy at Onondaga, and people had to be pretty good at remembering what it was that different groups had come with as their complaints and what had been agreed upon before. Because the protocol was to remind people what it was that we had done up until now. It was an ongoing, continuous scoreboard of here's where we are today. This idea, I think, is really very relevant today, because if you go to Washington or you go to London or anywhere, world leaders today don't have a plan about how to address the violence of chaos. They haven't a clue. What the plan was to go to someplace and beat the army. Okay, you went there, you beat their army, but you didn't get the result you were hoping for. Nobody stepped forward and surrendered their sword, and the country itself didn't surrender. What you got was you just beat up their army. And that was not dissimilar, really, to ways of thinking about it. No modern nation state has ever been able to hold out against an insurrection in the face of chaos. When a society collapses and you have guerrilla warriors and different competing groups inside there, you have a civil war going on their side, and the one thing that they're unified is to get rid of the invader. It's practically the only unified thing. But once they get rid of the invader, they'll be perfectly happy to kill one another. That's the secondary thing. In a chaos like that, there's no agreed upon method. How do you respond to it? The answer has been you use more force and more force and more force till you get to the point where you cannot apply any more force. You don't have any more force. You've maxed out. But the chaos is still happening in this. I say that the Six Nations Confederacy under the Great Law actually was born in that kind of environment and devised ways to address that kind of environment. But there's a trick. The people who are going to manage that, if you're going to stand forward and say, okay, I'm going to lead the way out of that jungle, those people can never lie. They have to be completely honorable all the time. They can't take sides. They have to be neutral. They have to be peacemakers. Peacemakers aren't people with an agenda. They don't come to your country to take your forest. They don't come there to kill your buffaloes. They're there to end the violence. That's all. So they have to be completely honorable, completely honest. And that's what I think the Six Nations Confederacy had as its thing. It was a culture, actually. The culture that was around the council was a culture of people who were dedicated to pursuing peace.
It was a matriarchal tilt of the Iroquois Confederacy, says Orrin Lyons, that played a big part in seeking out the leaders that would make pursuing peace a priority.
That was the work of the clan mother. That was the work of the women in choosing the leaders. All her choices had to be ratified by consensus. So even though she made a choice, it had to be agreed upon by either by the clan, by the Council of Chiefs, and finally by the whole Grand Council of Six Nations. This person is vetted all the way. But what is important is that the woman who made the choice is looking for qualities that are different from a war leader. She's looking for qualities that are different from your average president today. As you notice in the history of the United States, many of the presidents have been generals in the armies and so forth. And so you put a general in charge, you're going to get a man of war. I mean, what else is there? Some have risen above that. Eisenhower had some wonderful ideas about fairness and so forth, but that's not really the norm. So I would say that in choosing leaders then, that there has to be the process, and that was the genius of the process that the peacemaker brought and the responsibility of women in not only raising leaders but removing them as well.
Some final thoughts from John Mohawk.
Violence has to have some source. Now, I know people are going to come back next to them. No, it doesn't. Some people are just naturally violent. They're all psychotic and blah, blah, blah. Okay? The problem with that is that if people are really just psychotic, then your only chance is to kill them. It's the only hope. If you really believe that the opposition is so psychotic that nothing will stop them from killing people ever, you have to kill them all. Or you have to agree with the point that I think the Confederacy was founded on, which is that the man who's trying to kill you has reasons, or at least thinks he does, and he has family, and he has concerns. He has things that he values. He values some things more than he values his own life, obviously, because he's willing to go and expose himself to great danger to get what he wants. You need to find out what those things are, and you need to create an environment where he can believe that your intercession could be beneficial to him. So we're starting with that. So the first rule of power, your power to deal with your enemy, comes from your capacity to believe in his humanity. To the extent that you can believe in it, you can do something other than trying to kill him. Otherwise, you're powerless. You're just absolutely powerless. If you believe that you can't deal with him and there's no way to deal with him, then you have no power except to kill him. And of course, if you can't kill him, then where are you?
Our thanks to Professor Orrin Lyons of the American Studies Department at the New York State University at Buffalo, and to the late Professor John Mohawk, who was also teaching at New York State University at Buffalo at the time of his death in 2006. Special thanks as well to Deborah Kolodzak and Joyce Kryzak for production assistance. To hear this program again and for more about the Great Law of Peace of the Six Nations of the Iroquois, visit our website, peacetalksradio.com, and look for the episode called Peacemaking Traditions of the Iroquois Confederacy. Support for this program comes in part from the PRX Reversioning Project. Rate and review this program and hundreds of others at the Public Radio Exchange online at prx.org. Support also from the McCune Charitable Foundation of New Mexico and from KUNM in Albuquerque. Music by Ali Adelman. I'm Paul Ingalls. Thanks for listening.
Peace train sounding loud. Glide on the peace train. Isekaya. Isekaya. Come on, peace train.
At the end of our Peace Talk shows, we sometimes like to feature our staff's pick for a peace song that expresses a writer or singer's best wish for a more peaceful world. Today, the man who had a 1970s hit with the song Peace Train re-recorded it nearly 30 years later. By then, Cat Stevens had long ago become a Muslim and changed his name to Yusuf Islam. Here's his updated version of Peace Train.
I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come. And I believe it could be someday it's going to come. Well, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world as one. And I believe it could be someday it's going to come. Someday it's going to come. Come take me home again.
come on the peace train. Someday it's going to come. Come on the peace train. Take me home again. Oh, peace train sounding louder. Glide on the peace train. Come on the peace train. Is out on the edge of darkness, there rides the peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country, come take me home again. Oh, I've been smiling lately, thinking about the world as one. And I believe it could be, someday it's going to come. Someday it's going to come, come take me home again. Come on the peace train. Someday it's going to come. Come on the peace train. Take me home again. Someday it's going to come. Someday it's going to come. Someday, someday, someday it's going to come.
Go on, Haiti. Why can't we live in bliss?
Peace train sounding louder. Glide on the peace train. Come on, peace train. Someday it's going to come. Come take me home again. Come on the peace train. Someday it's going to come. Come on the peace train. Take me home again. Come take me home. Come take me home. Come take me home again. Someday it's going to come. Come take me home again. Come on, peace train.
Someday it's going to come. Come take me home again. Come on, peace train. Someday it's going to come.
Come take me home again. Come take me home.